those things, those requirements of marriage.
But at the age of 18, for example.
And
yes, people are different. And the number of people that I see and I have seen in the course of my life, and they married at a very young age, most often they are very much regretful about why they got married so soon.
You know, because my stream is psychology itself.
Yeah, but we also have the other way around.
Well,
people are regretful why they got married so late.
Yeah, we have that, but I don't know why, but I have this mentality that those are exceptions, and exceptions do not break the rules.
Definitely. You know, because my stream is psychology.
I guess the key is maturity.
Intellectual maturity
is very important. Just like
about,
the brother has stated, even over here, like he should feel himself that he is ready. But you know, sometimes this even doesn't work. Why? Because, of course, from a psychological perspective, because my
studies
is in psychology.
Since you are an expert in psychology.
And alhamdulillah, many people have consulted as well with this regards. And I have seen, unfortunately, at a lot of places, I myself was in place like giving consultation to the participants, or I would say individuals who would come near me. And I have seen people who told themselves that they are ready and have entered marriage, and they got married, and after a few months the marriage got broke, like it went up till divorce. And they got divorced because they were not good with intellectual stability, like they were not intellectually mature, though they were thinking that they are completely ready.
Yeah.
So this thing happens. That's the reason I brought this concept of consultation example. If they,
so the consultant was saying that they're not ready, and
according to me, he was not ready, but still he was like, I'm ready for sure. Like, I know about myself. I have money. I have financial stability. I know that I can get married, and I can provide my wife, a house and everything, whatever she wants. And after they got married, there were a number of issues, like a lot. The wife would cry day and night, like no other day, unfortunately. I don't want to go into details. I've seen these kind of cases a lot. Like the brother Muhammad's brother example, his case is exceptional, just like over here.
I do.
But you have to. But there are people who would say, I'm ready. Example, myself, okay. When I was at the age of 18, I would say 19, near about 19, I thought that I'm ready. And I went to see a scholar, and I was like, okay, can I get married now? Because I think I'm ready. I can provide for my family. He was like, no, you're not ready. You're thinking that you're ready, but you're wrong. And later on, after a year or two, I asked him the reason.
So according to him, what you were lacking?
Sorry?
And according to that scholar, what was your lack?
Okay, just in one short word, my intellect maturity. The maturity of my intellect, okay? At the age of 22, when I went to him, every year I would go near him and I would tell him my ideologies, my beliefs, everything. Like, I would sit with him properly for an hour. And he's a very good scholar, by the way. And he would analyze everything. He would say, no, you're not ready. I would be like, oh, what's lagging in me? And at the age of 22, he heard and he asked me questions, a lot of questions. And now you're ready. At the age of 22, I got married. Alhamdulillah, it worked well for me.
So, you know, I guess it's not the matter of a specific age as much as it is the matter of the framework of your mentality. Kindness even to forget about ourselves and even think about others. So this becomes an important matter in marriage. Like, there are some other factors as well. So this maturity is the thing that would actually decide for you, for marriage, I guess. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, ya Rabbal alameen, ya Rahmanu, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again. Ya Allah, ya Rabbal alameen, يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أمى رائزك Let us see daylight again once again.
We are with you. What about you? with IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history. Imam Khamenei. The most important element of unity is the existence of Muhammad, peace be upon him. We say that the holy existence of the great Prophet and Messenger of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, is the most important point in creating unity. He is superior to other prophets in terms of morality and nature. And he is peerless in terms of knowledge and generosity. And all of them beseech the Messenger of God to grant them a drop from his infinite sea and a drip of his boundless and immeasurable rain. The holy existence of the Messenger of God is the summit of the world and the best spot in the universe in the true sense of the word. The Holy Quran has referred to itself as light. One of the words that the Holy Quran uses to describe itself is light. God has indeed sent upon you light and the book. The Holy Quran, chapter 5, verse 15. The Holy Quran is light. One of the esteemed wives of the Holy Prophet was asked to describe him, and she said in response, "The Holy Quran is in his nature." This means that he was the living Quran, so he was light as well. Light is a means of providing brightness and ensuring the life of humans. The Holy Prophet, too, is a means of providing brightness and ensuring the life of human societies. There are things that humanity will reach gradually. The holy existence of the Messenger of God is a source of light in the true sense of the word. And our poet says, "Guidance was born and light has imbued all creatures." This is really the truth of the matter. And time is smiling and uttering words of praise. I hope that the world of Islam will be like this as well. I hope that the world of Islam smiles on the birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet, that it will not suffer from sorrow and grief. This is our dream. I have written down three points to discuss with you. One is about Unity Week. We in the Islamic Republic have named this week, starting from the 12th of Rabi'ul Awwal and lasting until the 17th of Rabi'ul Awwal, as Unity Week. Such naming is not just for the sake of it, and it is not a political and tactical move either. Rather, such naming is based on the belief and heartfelt faith.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
Welcome, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Thank you for joining us. Please stay with us over the next hour for another selection of meaningful and enriching programs. We begin with Spotlight, a daily current affairs program that casts a careful eye on today's most significant international developments. Each episode features a roundtable discussion with two expert guests offering informed analysis and commentary. If you're looking to stay engaged with global events, this is your essential listen. Later, we'll bring you another segment of Radio Productions offering thoughtfully prepared audios, features designed to inform, inspire, and reflect. Up next is Spotlight. Stay with us.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A year ago today, the Israeli regime celebrated one of the most perverse acts of sabotage and terrorism the world has ever witnessed. Large-scale targeting of Lebanese civilians through pager and walkie-talkie explosions. Attacks that left at least 40 people dead and nearly 3,500 wounded. Israeli leadership claims operation was to target Hezbollah resistance members, yet devices detonated anywhere and everywhere, from family dinner tables to crowded markets, shops, public transportation, parks, schools, and even an embassy. What the occupation called an achievement, the world saw as a reckless and shameful destructive act, along with litany of other criminal acts that have defined the Zionist regime for over 75 years. The Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem today said Israel failed and continues to fail to take resistance fighters off the battlefield, and this is the focus of our Spotlight program. But first, here's a quick report.
Lebanon marks 1 year since a series of Israeli-coordinated explosions targeted Hezbollah's communication devices across the country. Thousands of pagers detonated simultaneously on September 17, 2024, followed by the explosion of numerous walkie-talkies the next day. Several countries slammed the attack as a terror attack, with the United Nations condemning it as a terrifying violation of international law, citing their indiscriminate nature. The two-day assault left at least 40 people dead and more than 3,400 injured, including children and civilians caught near the devices.
We even know that in war there is something called the ethics of war, but the enemy went beyond all of these things. He didn't think that the pager would be in the hands of children. We witnessed that there were many wounded children and women who had nothing to do with this matter.
Marking the anniversary, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem delivered a televised address honoring the victims of the attacks as pioneers of insight and symbols of eternal devotion.
You are at the higher level and know that Israel will fall because its occupation, injustice, criminality and aggression, and because the resistance fighters are confronting it until liberation, on the path to either of the two, and this is a permanent victory.
As Lebanon marks 1 year since the attack, the scars remain and so does the resolve. Despite the Lebanese government's U.S.-backed efforts to disarm Hezbollah movement, the resistance insists its weapons are not a threat to peace, but a shield against occupation and threats. Israel's continued strikes, even after a ceasefire agreement established in November 2024, prove that surrendering to the regime's demand will not bring security. From Gaza to Lebanon, the resistance sees itself not as a destabilizing force, but as the last line of defense for dignity, sovereignty, and survival.
And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Mohammed Qassem, academic and political analyst, joining us from Beirut. and Arnold August, author and journalist and contributing editor at Canada Files, joining us from Montreal. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both on. I guess we'll start there in Beirut with you, Mr. Qasem. Good to have you join the program. Your first take on how you remember last year's pager attacks by the Israeli occupation entity in Lebanon.
I think that the Israelis had the intention of doing such an action before, years ago, and they were preparing for this massacre against the Lebanese. But they did choose the special time to activate it, because Israel has many motives for doing such an action. The first of all, they had found that the resistance had been so powerful and were able to attack and support Gaza. That's why they wanted to cripple the resistance command control and the coordinating systems. This is one. The second motive that Israel wanted of this war is that they were trying to make a kind of psychological warfare by instilling fear and paranoia. And in this way, they would break the morale, and they make a kind of mistrust of the equipment that the resistance is using, and they are were trying also to reduce the operational efficiency of the resistance. Another motive of Israel was to deter against escalation. You know, at that time, the Lebanese resistance was ready to go forward and to proceed with the support of Gaza, but the escalation that the resistance was doing had a great effect on Israel. That's why the Israelis wanted to make a kind of deterrence against the escalation, especially with the rockets that the resistance were using, the missiles, and other forms. Also, it was a kind of a message to Iran and to the region, and it is to show them that they are superior in technology as well as superior in intelligence. It is also, to some extent, it is kind of a field test, infiltration, and they wanted to show that this action can be done. But another message that Israel was trying to do is a message for the internal situation of Israel. It is a kind of a domestic message for protests. You know, at that time, there were many protests, and the political divisions that were taking place at that time, and the criticism over the massacres that Israel was doing against Gaza. And this was also trying to calm the division inside Israel, and they wanted to tell them that we are making all our abilities to succeed in that. But
thank you.
Would that be enough for them, or was it a main reason for this escalation? I think that the 17th of September, which we consider as it is the war of pagers, and walkie-talkie on the second day. That's we call it here in Lebanon. It is the anniversary of the recovery. Mm. Our slogan today is that we recovered. This is what the injured had said all
Thank
over
you.
The country. And this
Mr.
slogan
Kassim,
had been proven during the demonstration.
Mr. Qasem, please, we don't have much time. I want to have both of you speak. Mr. Arnold August, thank you for your patience, sir. Good to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure.
If you remember this time last year after this attack, Israeli leadership, they laughed, they danced, they paraded around as if they pulled off what, the most genius operation of the century. Many saw the very exact opposite. How did you see it?
Well, I think what you're saying and the previous speaker saying, the main goal, I think, was while U.S. and Israel were losing the war in Gaza as well as in Lebanon, that specific attack was aimed to try to show once again the superiority of the U.S.-Israeli war machine being used to carry out the Holocaust. And, of course, what they not only they did it, you saw it dancing in the streets, but it also had wide diplomatic implications when various representatives of Israel visited other countries, for example, in Washington, D.C. On live camera, they made jokes. How about if you, how would you like to have a pager on you? I mean, there are many examples how they actually made jokes of the slaughter that took place against the Lebanese people by the U.S.-backed Israeli armed forces. But I think 1 year later, did they succeed in intimidating the resistance movement? No. Did they succeed in stifling the opposition within Israel, even though it is limited to Netanyahu? No, it has actually increased. The resistance has increased, and the opposition within Israel by the so-called, you know, liberal wing of Zionism has also increased. And despite its limitations, it acts as a very important stop or a way to hold Netanyahu accountable, even though we're not seeing. Resistance has definitely increased, and so has the opposition within Israel increased as well. Israel, in fact, is falling apart at the seams. We have to be patient. I am sure in the coming weeks and months, it eventually is going to fall apart because of the economic problem, the contradiction within Zionism, and the opposition U.S. Zionist attack against the Palestinian people. It does not go down well at all with the Israeli population, even though they had that spectacular success in Lebanon a year ago with those pagers.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Qasem, if any other government or regime on this planet was to carry out a similar reckless act like this, where civilians are in the direct line of fire and in imminent danger, the tag of state sponsor of terrorism would be put upon them, followed by sanctions and repercussions. Leadership would be held to account. But with this regime, we see a prime minister running around the world, I'm sure you've seen golden pagers to Western politicians as mementos to celebrate this brazen act of terrorism. Your thoughts on the double standards when it comes to the Israeli regime?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear well. The line is not functioning well. But what did I understand of what your question is? The government's reaction to this war of pagers. This is if it is like that, I will say that unfortunately our government was not in that suitable position. The negligence and not any effort was done by the government and by the official institutions in Lebanon to face such a catastrophe when we have not less than 20 dead people, martyrs, and about 3,000 wounded, and they were left open to the initiatives of people, or initiatives of some social workers or some doctors who had been volunteers to do the job. That's why they were left for their environment or for their society, and unfortunately, the wounded, they had very big and very critical time with no one to help, except some initiatives done by some social organizations or local organizations that the people did. That's why when we see that we have injuries, wounded in their eyes, in their hands, in their abdomens, in their lungs, in their waist, all these, they needed special care, they needed medical operations and so on. It took a long time to be adjusted to that, and it is good that we have the institutions related to the resistance that was also supporting with some other organizations that they did. But here we can say that we are praising the initiatives of the doctors, of the nurses, of the working of health care and so on, and their reaction to this. And this was so good that it helped in making the loss less. Mm. That's why they were with no equipments, no surgical equipments, and so on. But it passed, and now by 1 year, we can see that these wounded people are now completely different persons. They are militants. They are proud of themselves. We will talk about that, I think, in the other question. But we are so proud of these people who were wounded, and they are around 3,000. Their demonstration today was so great that they were walking proudly. They were saying that, okay, we have lost our eyes or hands or fingers or ribs or and so on, but we rehabilitated ourselves. We are now adjusting to our situations. Some of them are now working. Some of them did marry. Others were studying in the universities. Some others are working as social workers and in different fields. And they had been changed, or they are completely changed from one person to another. They are more active in the society now. And they said that we have lost some of our parts, but we are more involved in our country's problems and issues, and we should proceed in our track of resistance. They are now proving that they are a new resistance people who are able to face all the obstacles of life in a very self-confident situation.
Thank you, sir.
And I would like to say that
can I ask Mr.
It is a
August.
Kind of another form of
thank you. Let me just say, Mr. Arnold August, so when you put last year's pager attacks and then the war that followed, and you put it next to the ceasefire in November 27th and the thousands upon thousands of ceasefire violations, the continued occupation by Israel of Lebanese soil up until this very day, how do you find the pretext or the justification to speak of disarming Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Amal or any resistance faction in the region when you realize who you're up against?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's complete double standard. They, you know, brazenly talk about disarming Hamas, talking about recognizing a new Palestinian state, but without Hamas. In other words, give up your arms, they are saying to Hamas. And what does that mean in real terms? Just to facilitate the Holocaust that has been going on in recent times since October 7, 2023, and as well as right from the beginning, from 1948. You asked whether any other countries have carried out such a of raising attack against individual citizens, as was carried out by Israel with the pager attacks. From as far as I know, no. I don't think there's been anything like it. However, we have to ask the following question. Is the guilty party only Netanyahu, a wild card Netanyahu? I think it would be wrong for us to think that the problem in the Middle East is Netanyahu. The problem in the Middle East is U.S. full unconditional support for Israel, including, for example, the pager attack that took place, on all of the other attacks that took place, for example, against Iran, against the Palestinian people. Like right now as we speak, they're also occupying and arresting people in the occupied bank, trying to take over Gaza City. This is the reality of the situation. The pager incident is just part of U.S.-Israeli policy in the United States to eliminate the Palestinian people. Yes.
And the U.S. today is pushing the Ayoun government to basically try to disarm Hezbollah in Lebanon.
That's terrible. I mean, I'm sure the Lebanese people, knowing personally from people who live there, militants, intellectuals, etc., including who you're on TV today, there's no way the Lebanese people will give up their arms because the United States and Israel wants them to give up arms. On the contrary, what is happening and what is going to happen is that the Lebanese people will rise once again. Just as George Abbas, after spending all those years in prison, he came back undefeated in Beirut as a hero because he stands up for the Palestinian people. This is Lebanon. They will not give up arms. They will keep on fighting against the United States and Israel.
And I really want to put that same question to Mr. Mohammad Qasem. Mr. Mohammad Qasem, this case that the U.S. is trying to make and give these guarantees, it knows it cannot give to Beirut to disarm Hezbollah. When you look at Israel's track record over the last 40 years in Lebanon, over the last 75 years in Palestine, how do you justify disarming the resistance?
I think that the Lebanese government, and especially the prime minister, is doing a very fatal action, and the ministry, the whole ministry had taken a very dramatic as well as a very dangerous decision that they are trying or they are working on disarming the resistance as well as disarming the Palestinians. What we know of this, there are many motives for that. The disarming means what? It is, first of all, they are trying to break down all the power that the Lebanese had gained for years and years and had paid for that, thousands of martyrs, as well as suffering and troubles all over years, economically, socially, security, and so on. This minister now, or the prime minister, who is insisting and trying to pull the legs of all the cabinet or the ministers in order to force this kind of disarmament. The disarmament means that they wanted us to be open to the enemy. And this is according to what Trump says or orders, and why, and this is what Ortegas as well as Barack had planned and are trying to do that. If we take a kind of statistics or a kind of asking a poll within the Lebanese, there was a very neutral poll was done by more than one institution. It proved that there are still, even with these casualties and destruction and occupying of five villages, and still the Israelis are in the south, there are more than 60 to 65% of the Lebanese population who refuse or who asks the resistance not to give their arms to the government, and they said that we are still feeling or we are in need of this weapon to face the cruelty and the massacres that Israel had done. While I'm talking to you now, a kind of air raid have been made against Baalbek, which is so far more than 200 to 300 kilometers from the borders to the north of Lebanon, and they had killed more than one martyr. This is, I don't know what the prime minister wants on insisting of disarming or taking the army of the resistance. It means one thing to a logical person which says that why you signed for a treaty where the first item of this is the withdrawal of the enemy, leaving the villages that had been occupied, releasing the hostages,
okay.
Rebuilding the destroyed or the destructed houses, and then we discuss the disarming, or at least to a strategic policy of Lebanon, especially according to the defense strategy.
Thank
why
you,
you are insisting only yes. on disarming the resistance? It means he is under the orders of the United States and Israel as well.
Thank you, both of you, sincerely for joining us on the program. It's a pleasure to have you both on. Mr. Mohammed Qasem, they're joining us from Beirut, and also Mr. Arnold August joining us from Montreal. It brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Continue our journey through the province of Charmahal Bakhtiari. We've set our sights on two villages that we've been told can thrill any traveler. But before we were able to dive into the architectural world of the villages of our choice, we came across a very beautiful pond 23 kilometers from Shahrikort, located in the entertainment complex of Gerdabi Ben, or Ben's Whirlpool, that's set to have an area of 38,000 square kilometers. The beautiful scenery and the sunshine reflected off the surface of the water were so tempting that we decided to take a few turns on the paddle boats. One of the things we all enjoy during the summer is a day out with family and friends. You can pack a picnic lunch, get out your favorite blanket and a couple of fun games, and spend the day outdoors. And there are a lot of places in the city of Ben, in Charmahal and Bakhtiari, where people do exactly that. With fully recharged batteries after our little fun detour on the pond, we set out towards our first destination, a remote village in the central Zagros Highlands. We have some 150 kilometers ahead of us before we reach the village of Saragha Seyed. To get to the Saragha Seyed village, you have to go past Kuhran County through a long and winding dirt road. The Saragha Seyed village from afar, you'd think you were looking at beautiful stairways going up the side of the mountain.
this kind of compact housing formation where your door opens onto the roof of the house that's right below you is rarely seen in Iran. Only a handful, and this is one of them. Apart from the amazing view, the upside to this interesting architecture is that everyone can have their own patio.
It's as though time stopped in this village at some point, for the architecture is still very similar to its original style, an architecture that's unique in the rural and urban context of the Bakhtiari settlements. Even so, the passage of the years has left its mark on the face of this village, on the houses that were built a few hundred years ago. I don't believe any of the images we show you can truly portray this scenery and the villagers' way of life. Destination is a village that's in the northeastern part of Charmaholo Bakhtiari, a village in the mountainous areas of the county of Saman along the riverbanks of Zoyande Rud.
Yasir Shah is a village that was built in the mountains during the Safavid era, so it's really old. The houses are built from clay, wood and brick, and some of the streets and alleys are still covered.
The name of the Yasir Shah village is derived from its geographical location. Most of the villagers speak the Turkish dialect, and in Turkish, Yasir Shah refers to a part of the river that's wider than the rest. The houses are heartwarmingly simple. Luckily, because of the interest tourists have shown in such places, most of the houses are being restored while keeping their original historic and old texture, turning some of them into ecotourism resorts. These historic and far-flung villages can entice any traveller. The calming experience of this adventure is hard to let go indeed. Hard as it is, nevertheless, we have to head back home. This is Golnar Farnoodi for Iran.
Qazvin is located next to one of Iran's main north-south transit corridors. Many people driving along this road also pay a visit to this historic city. And one of the reasons is to eat. So my curiosity dragged me all the way to downtown Qazvin to find out more about food culture in this city.
It is time to get ready for a festival of color and flavor. Everyone's invited. In the city's historic caravanserai lies a kitchen where they turn ingredients into magic. If there is one place you should forget about your diet, it would be right here.
If you're on a gastronomic journey across Iran, you would easily be able to find Iran's national dishes in every restaurant on your way. But to get a taste of more folklore food, sometimes you have to travel to particular areas of the country, such as Qazvin City. That is where I am right now, in one of its traditional restaurants. I suggest we take a look into the kitchen to see what Qazvini cuisine is all about.
Traditional Qazvini foods are made of some of the best ingredients in the world. It's a pity we can't show you the whole process of preparing all these dishes due to our short program. Only looking at each dish is enough to awaken that dragon in your belly.
Thank you. addition to exclusive dishes, the people in this city pay a lot of attention to what they drink. That's why traditional drinks made of herbs and seeds are extremely popular here. We're going to try one of the best cafes in town to see how the people in Qazvin cool down and relax, especially in a hot summer day like this.
In the old times, bathing had its own traditions. One of them was to treat yourself with traditional drinks called sharbat and brewed herbs after you came out of the bath. That was when the owner of the sharbat house prescribed you a drink that would help you shape up after a long bath. He did this by simply looking at the color of your face.
Our journey would not be complete without tasting the very special sweets and pastries of Qazvin city, baklava or baklava. It's a bomb of energy and happiness, the richest and the most outstanding edible souvenir of Qazvin city. I'm going to have one, and then we're going to see how it's made.
To the people in Qazvin, baklava is pride. It is so important that no visitor leaves a city without it. In every corner of this country, you're guaranteed a warm and friendly hospitality. Iran, the land of endless flavors and new experiences. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي